Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
I'm at a little bit of a crossroads here, guys. I would like to deal with the theoretical issue that you raised earlier, Boyd, about a diffusionist theory of an original religion and all these things being piece of it. But what you were talking about there with the kind of the pattern that you know he was doing and he said is meaningful, that also ties into probably the main competing type of theory to the diffusionist model, which would be the more archetypal Jungian approach to, you know, when you see parallels out there. Are you guys ready for that, or is there anything else you want to kind of deal with, like in terms of like Hugh really went hard in this, that, or the other thing and he nailed it, or it's super influential? I just don't want to leave. I don't want to leave that part to go into theoretical unless you guys are ready.
I don't have anything else.
And I'll give you guys a chance to tell some personal stories, or you know, like role he's played in your life or your spirituality a little bit later. But so if you guys are ready for that, I'd like to do it. So Boyd, would you frame what you did a little bit earlier, which is Hugh seeing all these patterns for him was sort of a search for remnants of an ancient religion that was probably revealed in a pure form, and then through the different cultures and time and separation, it kind of broke into these different pieces. Would you at least articulate, however best you can, that theory?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just did. The theory that it just had, you know, originally been established, that the church, the gospel had been established on earth to Adam and Eve, and then diffused down through generations and generations, and you know, been lost, but the remnants are still there, and we find it in all these different cultures. Hugh's vision, though, was broader than just that, and so this is a point I think that sometimes many of the people who use Hugh kind of miss. Hugh would not be opposed to Carl Jung's collective unconscious ideas. In fact, I think he'd find harmony within the two of them. Hugh, I mean, I saw when we went down, for example, to visit the Hopi, I saw him, you know, not only mentioning things that he saw in the Hopi ritual that, you know, he saw in ancient religions and Mormon culture. You know, he talked about Mormon temple endowment rituals and compare it to the Hopi religion. But he'd also point out things in the Hopi tradition that maybe we had lost. You know, so I don't think Hugh had this idea that Mormons had a monopoly on everything. And, he certainly believed that, you know, just I think as Joseph Smith did, that, you know, we can learn as much from other cultures as we can by, you know, it's not just a one-way missionary effort, I think, for Hugh.
Either of you other guys want to weigh in at the general level on that?
I think one of the challenges to the Iliade and Jungian and these kinds of things, where you're kind of looking at a diffusionist. By the way, diffusion, you know, I mean, you can find Joseph F. Smith talking about diffusion. I mean, it goes back before Nidley, but you run into some challenges there. You'll find this with the review of Nibley and the Timely and the Timeless by Kent Jackson, where Kent Jackson brings out the point that if you're going to look at things from a diffusionary perspective or an Iliadian perspective, where you're looking at all of these possible parallels, then you've got to come up with a methodology in terms of tying them together somehow, because they're too disparate. We're reaching into different, totally, you know, thousands of years apart parallels here, and that is a challenge. That's a real challenge to try and understand, well, what are we going to do with these? Are they parallels then, or what is a parallel? How do we make a parallel? And so modern scholarship maybe goes more into a synchronic, where they just look at a specific period of time, which Nibley did with the Book of Mormon, I think, just put it right in that period of time and then see what kind of things emerge from that, or a diachronic way, maybe what's happening over time, but keep the connections going if you can, making sure that you're not just pulling things out of the blue here from way different time zones and languages and cultures and these kinds of things. And that was, you know, Nibley, I think, did get challenged on that. Does that sound right to you, Kevin or Boyd?
Yeah, it does. When we talk about, this diffusionism type of thing, you know, we have to remember that Hugh was a human being, and like all human beings, you know, he was influenced by the scholarly fashion of his time. And Hugh himself talks about, in the 1930s, the what was called the Cambridge School of Patternism, or myth and ritual. And so a lot of Hugh's approach comes from that scholarly fashion, which was prominent in the 1930s, of which he took to and used extensively in his work. And then eventually that school of thought kind of goes out of fashion, but Hugh keeps on with it. So Hugh was, in some respects, like every academic is, he was a creature of his academic training and of his time.
Yeah, and just the paradigm type thing, and when it shifts, it takes a while, to redo it. What's happening today in terms of, Brian, maybe you're the best to do it. Which folks in Farms the Maxwell Institute and the major apologists right now are still, fine with approaching things from that diffusionist original religion, these are remnants, versus the folks that might be talking about, hey, whenever you see water, guess what? Water is cleansing, and that doesn't mean necessarily that it's baptism.
Right. Well, you still see a couple different schools of thought out there within the apologetic world. You still have a very strong force of parallel where you're going through and you're looking at the ancient world and you're finding these parallels. Then you're going to Joseph Smith and you're saying, you know, this stuff was not available to Joseph Smith at the time. And then you have the drum roll, so to speak. And then it says, aha, this kind of supports the idea that Joseph Smith was a prophet. And you still get that. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is, yes, let's look at the text. Let's look at intertextuality. Let's look at, if we can, textual dependency, those kinds of things. There's other scholars out there that are saying, even apologists that are saying, I'm not going to really focus on the parallels unless you can find them through textual evidence. And
I see. Yeah.
You see, and so that's, and I'm not saying that these two schools are battling it out. Some might say they are. About the two schools of thought are kind of doing their own thing anyway, and they're going to continue to do their own thing. But this is what you're going to see happening more and more is the Maxwell Institute, for instance. You've got people there that are very, I mean, it's very, you've got the Center for Preservation of Ancient Religious Texts that Christian Heal is over doing, lots with Syriac texts, those kinds of things. Or Morgan Davis doing Islamic texts, but it's all text-based, you see. And it's not so much focusing now on parallels as it is on textual elucidation. What can we learn from these texts? What can these texts teach us about how we might learn from our own textual traditions, such as the scriptures? How might it elucidate our understanding of the scriptures? Not so much in terms of parallels, but in terms of what texts teach us about how texts have been received and such. Does that make sense?
Really helps.
I think in the apologetic world, I think there's an awareness of these critiques of nibbling. And I think that has had an effect. So I don't think you find people as willing to do these, you know, broad, you know, in terms of space and time parallels without any kinds of controls as maybe Hugh was wont to do. Because people are aware that there was a criticism of Hugh doing that, and in some measure at least it was probably a valid criticism. And so I think there's a tendency to try to put more controls on the adducing of parallels, you know, both in space and in time and textually. So I think in some ways he was served as almost a negative example for people working apologetically today.
Awesome.
And of course, Farms, you know, Farms is coming out of the early 90s, maybe was it the mid 80s, something like that. And Farms is kind of a response in a way to the shutting down of the new Mormon history, the Camelot period that Arrington had started. And so when Farms comes on the picture, they pick right up on what Nibley was doing, and they go great guns on that for many, many, many years. But now you're seeing, as Kevin was saying, kind of, you know, trying to get more controls with this, a little bit tighter control on what we're doing with our scholarship because of those criticisms. And because the rest of the scholarly world has moved on from Iliade and some of these grand patterns that had been out there those years before, and are now trying to develop methodologies and controls to do more intertextuality based things.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting phenomenon that you're seeing happening today with apologetics.
Can I propose a theory that I have no clue if you guys will agree with or not? You've been mentioning, you know, what's happening among those who are really doing, you know, the work in the Maxwell Institute, the folks doing the scholarship who are aware of these critiques of the patternism and all that stuff. Would you say, though, that the average person who's reading Farms reviews and, you know, Journal of Book of Mormon Studies and things like that, when they're reading and seeing the ancient world talked about in ways that, you know, place these texts in that show that there's some echoes and resonances with these time periods, would you say that the average person is mostly still pretty excited about it because at that psychological level, it's like, okay, wow, Joseph Smith really is restoring something, you know, that was actually rooted in reality and their faith is bolstered. And so if that's the case, that maybe this is my proposal, that there's a psychological advantage to the diffusionist theory, do you see the textual stuff resonating at anything close to that same degree, or will it ever have a chance to do that, or is it just such technical work that probably the average person that's just looking for a boost of faith is going to stick with diffusionist?
Well, I think that, you know, what we're seeing is with diffusion still being published, like in the Journal Book of Mormon Studies and such, that, yeah, you're going to see some people get excited about that. There's no question about it. And probably if you want to really get down to the brass tacks of really try to get some tight controls of things in scholarship, it's probably going to be kind of boring for some people. I'm a slogger. That's me. I slog through stuff. You know, I'm looking at everything from, you know, the just every word, every paragraph, those kinds of things, and try to look at different texts in very close relationships and whether they're not related. I'm not one that feels as comfortable maybe to do a comparative, you know, textual thing, saying, well, you know, here's an ancient text that's supporting the Book of Mormon or something like that, because I'm a slogger. I don't do it that way. That's just not me. And I respect those that do that. I'm not putting them down, but that's just not the way I am. And so somehow we as scholars need to help people understand what we're trying to do. Even if it is more boring, it's more tedious, you know, the tight control, still we need to help people understand what we're, that maybe these parallels are interesting, but yet when you really get down to studying them in a very close, specific way, they sort of fall by the wayside, a lot of them. A lot of them don't stand up to scrutiny very well. And I could give you some examples, but I think I'm not going to.
Right, that's fine. Yeah, no, you've answered my question. Kevin or Boyd, is there any disagreement with what he was saying?
Not from my end, no.
No, I agree.
And that's my sense of it. But I guess, Brian, I think in some ways my asking this serves well because, coming from the folks who don't read the text themselves, who only read the secondary critiques of apologetics and things like that, it's just important for people like you to have these forums where you can come on and say, look, we're wrestling with this within our own community. Apologetics is trying to follow where the texts take us. There's been paradigm shifts. Some people have shifted, some people haven't. And we know that there's always going to be that greater heft and weight given to, a parallel if it makes these things that Joseph Smith was messing with in the 19th century feel more real as if they're rooted in something back then. Just by saying that out loud, I think we've done some service here.
I'd have to add, I think the discussion has shifted among the general populace too. Younger members of the church, my sense is, as a college teacher, I don't think they feel this kind of antagonistic defense of the church, attack of the church that previous generations had. These kids grew up in the Gordon B. Hinckley era when, he was more in favor of outreach and getting along with our neighbors. And so I think that the young people today tend to not be as concerned about the, either or questions so much as the what's the text saying. And, here's, I think, where Nibley, so this might be a good segue for the next episode, but I think this is where Nibley really contributes something that's still very valuable. Nibley was a good reader of the social aspects of these texts and what are they actually saying, one part of his reading of the Book of Mormon was to situate it into this ancient world, but another thing was to point out what the Book of Mormon's actually saying about issues of wealth and social justice, issues of war and peace, and those kind of issues, I think, really still have a great deal of resonance today.
Absolutely.
And there's so many ways that you can study the scriptures. I mean, if you look at the Book of Mormon, you can look at, when I was talking to Sam Brown one time, he said, why doesn't somebody do something on how the pre-church imitators, if you recall the Ghanaian imitators in Africa, how they looked at the Book of Mormon, how they used the Book of Mormon before they were official.
Right.
That would be interesting. There's lots of ways of looking at the text. You got Joe Spencer, who's looking at the text from a theological perspective. It doesn't have to be an either-or situation. You don't have to just go at it and say, well, we've got to prove the Book of Mormon true here.
Historical, yeah. Historicity or not, yeah. Terrific. Thank you so much. Well, we talked about parallelomania, and that's kind of in the area of critiques of Hughes' stuff, or really it's more of a critique of the paradigm of examining religions and things like that. But that at least leads us into an area where we ought to probably at least address the one other major critique of Nibley's scholarship that sometimes comes up, and that is that some of his footnotes have been challenged as being accurate. I mean, I've heard it. I haven't read it recently. Is anybody going out of their way, Boyd, I'll start with you, to say that he's deliberately deceiving, or is it just like he's sloppy? But somehow I know that there's been a problem with his footnotes, at least according to some people.
Yeah, I think there have been a few people who've made, hay out of this idea that Nibley is not perfect. And, it's kind of funny because it's like suddenly they find an error in his footnotes and the whole church is supposed to fall over.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it's much ado about very little, but, to be sure, there are some problems, so I don't want to underemphasize that, but I think that they're also overemphasizing the kind of problems.
Well, do you want to present what, kind of both prongs of that, or Kevin or Brian, are either of you guys super aware of these critiques and maybe could start us out?
Sure. There's actually an essay on this very subject that was published by Shirley Ricks in the Farms Review, which is now defunct. But so if you go to you know the Maxwell Institute website and go on to authors and search on Shirley Ricks' name, you'll find it. She has a whole article on this subject of you know critiques of Hugh Nibley's footnotes. Shirley's article in particular was a response to a piece written by Ron Huggins, who at the time, I believe, was a professor at Salt Lake Theological Seminary. And, of course, that school closed. I think he's in Kansas now. And he published that in the Salt Lake City Messenger, which is the newsletter organ of the Utah Lighthouse Ministry, Sandra Tanner's organization. Now, Ron, when in his article, he framed it in something of an unfortunate way. He began his piece by quoting Martha Becht from her book, Leaving the Saints, who told the story of being in a grocery store and being approached by a man in a tweed jacket who told her that 90% of Hugh's footnotes were fabricated.
90? Wow.
90%. And I think that was unfortunate because certainly there are critiques available to be made of Hugh's footnotes. We can talk about, you know, he was sloppy, and, you know, I'm sure occasionally he misrepresented something or had an aggressive translation of something. But when you start with a quote like that, it colors everything that follows. And it's so absurdly ludicrous, you know, to say that, you forget 90%, let's say that's hyperbole, but to say any significant percentage of his footnotes were simply fabricated, you know, that boggles the mind. I mean, so I think that was a significant problem of that particular attempt at critique. It was a framing issue by using Martha's quote.
And so the Rick's reply shows what? What was her approach to refute Huggins?
Well, she kind of divided it up. I mean, saying the footnotes are problematic is too broad a statement. You have to say, well, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. And so she divided it up by saying, first of all, you know, what about sloppiness? And there, you know, in a certain degree, you know, guilty as charged. I mean, he made every possible error. One is able to make in his footnotes. Pages transposed, wrong years for the date of a journal, you know, that sort of thing. Now, of course, if you read the collected works of Hugh Nibley, those notes have all been checked by an army of source checkers. And so those should be correct. There might be some mistakes that, you know, made their way through. But if you look at the older editions, the did not have that rigorous source checking, you know, you can find, you know, mistakes and problems like that. But those are just human errors. You know, that doesn't mean the source is fabricated. It, you know, means maybe the page number's wrong or the year number's wrong, but the source is still there. So that's one category of problem, and I think everyone agrees, yeah, that problem exists in some measure, but it's not that big of a deal. But then you go to, you know, did he misrepresent sources? And there, so what Shirley did was, since she was an editor at the Maxwell Institute, you know, she was involved in this source-checking process. And, you know, Jack Welch, of course, was an editor of the Collected Works. So he organized, you know, basically this army. Some volunteers, some were students at BYU who were employed for the purpose. So whenever they published one of these collected works, they would source check every footnote. And so Shirley went to a lot of these people and talked to them about what their experience was. And everyone confirmed that, you could be a little bit sloppy and sometimes it was hard to find what he was talking about. But there wasn't a lot of confirmation for the idea of, you know, misrepresenting sources, or certainly not for making them up. And so that's kind of the gist of her review.
All right.
And it's based on talking to the source checkers.
Cool. Cool. Brian, anything? It dawned on me when you gave the example earlier of him speed reading some Arabic that you said was 300 pages and dense, and some of the stuff that you disagreed with the conclusion of his came out of that. Is that, would that be something that, like, would ever cross your mind as a deliberate on his part or anything like that?
No, I didn't really see it that way. I remember one time talking to Dan Peterson about Nibley's work, and Dan kind of, if I can get it right, Dan kind of described it this way. He said, Nibley is, picture a mansion with all sorts of rooms in it, with all sorts of interesting things inside each room, different from the next room. And Nibley is like, it's like Nibley going into that mansion and going into a room, taking some quick notes, and then running to the next room. I mean, he's only got a certain amount of time, and so he wants to get through all the rooms in that mansion and take his notes, and then kind of report on that. And that's kind of, you know, kind of describes maybe, you know, what we're seeing here. I mean, Nibley was able to, you know, to approach so many different disciplines and so many different areas of scholarship. And what was it, 14, 16 languages, something he knew? I mean, it's incredible. And also, you know, he was, you know, he comes from the older school of 3x5 cards. I remember, I can't remember who it was.
Wow,
I talked to about making his notes and going into Nibley's office, and maybe Boyd can say more about this, but just seeing these 3x5 cards scattered all over the floor, you know, that he's trying to work on a paper, and then he's got this old computer that I think he used pretty much even up to his old age there. Again, Boyd can maybe comment upon that a little bit. So we're looking at, you know, how he's doing his sources, those kinds of things, and sure, you're going to get mistakes, just like Kevin said. You're going to get wrong years for journals. You're going to get maybe a misquote here or something like that's going to happen. Nowadays, you know, things are different. We've got computer technology, those kinds of things to kind of help us keep things organized and such. And so, you know, we need to keep in mind, I think, those two things, that Nibley was fast and furious in his scholarship to get in as much as he possibly could. And then I think he was that old school note taker, you know, with 3x5 cards. I think that kind of helped me anyway understand why there might be some inconsistencies in his sources and such.
Cool.
Well, I'd just add a couple of things to that. I think, first off, you know, you're absolutely right. He did 3x5 note cards. And he used, because he was fast and furious, he used a combination of Greg's shorthand with other times, you know, characters from Arabic and Greek and all kinds of different languages mixed in. When he was working at the church office building trying to get Brigham Young quotes, they had a very careful security guard there who was checking everything that they'd pull out. He not only used Greg's shorthand, he'd try to use some code so that the guy couldn't possibly, they never checked. I mean, they checked dutifully, but he didn't know what he was reading. So, you know, his notes were really very unique, shall we say. And then, you know, there was this kind of scattering to the wind of these cards. I mean, Brian's right. He would place them in little stacks in places. He had shoeboxes all over the house. And then he'd reorganize these little note cards, you know, when he'd, you know, come up with different ideas for the way a paper would go, and things would end up in one place and then another. I mean, it really was a kind of creative flurry to see him work. One correction, though, he never used a computer. He used, for years, he used an old Underwood typewriter, not even electric. The big move up for him was getting an electric typewriter. Somebody tried to teach him how to use a computer and gave up very quick. It was just really too tough. So you know, part of this problem was really, you know, the way he was doing it, the there's no question that there were mistakes, but when you start looking at the method, it's pretty obvious why those mistakes were there. One of my favorite stories, though, came from, I can't remember who, I was talking to a source checker myself, and he said that when they were looking for sources, they went to this book they found and pulled it off the shelf, went to the page number. They had to special order this thing, I guess. Anyway, it was really hard to get the book. And they finally get it. They turn to the page, and there's a picture there. There's no way that this could be the thing that Hugh was quoting. So he went through the whole book looking for the quote that Hugh was quoting, couldn't find it, and finally he went up to Hugh and said, look, I don't know where this quote is. Could you find it? I've been through the entire book. And he says, well, look, it's on this page. And he turns to the page that had the picture, and he says, well, that's a picture. He says, yes, it's written on the rock in the background.
Oh, man.
Even transcribed. He was getting it from, so, you know, it's pretty, you know, Hugh was a very remarkable person, but sloppy, yes, but in a kind of delightful frenzy.
Interesting. I'd heard somebody challenge him once, like, it wasn't there or it wasn't there, and he goes, well, oh, I translated it myself. In other words, you know, yeah, I sent you to a source that's, you know, a well-known translation, but I was translating from the original source myself or something like that. Little things like that. The thing that also occurs to me is, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, I'll be reading through books that I'd marked up 10 years ago or so, and I'll say, why on earth did I write that thought in the margin here? And it's clear that at some point I had two or three thoughts cruising along in my head, and somehow I saw a connection, you know, between these thoughts that were, you know, they just happened to come together when I was on this page, and I made some note and margin here when they really weren't connected in any way except when you're inside your own head, you know what I mean? And I'm wondering if sometimes, you know, that's kind of what Hugh was doing. He'd stumble along here, but he had something percolating in his head, but because the crystallization of the idea came at this spot, he would, you know, cite that as a source or something.
I think that's a really good point, Dan. He was reading so many things, and he'd read them all at once. It was funny because he would, you know, sitting around the house, he'd be reading one book, and then, you know, you'd see a stack of five books there, and so, yeah, I think you're right. He was making connections where, you know, there probably really weren't connections to be made. But,
well, there or they were, but it took five steps to add them up. Yeah. And if you were to trace those, you'd see, but not otherwise.
Yeah,
you
know. I think that's true.
Brian or Kevin, any more thoughts just about that? I just wanted to make sure we didn't, you know, miss it, because it's something that pops up every once in a while about Hugh.
The marginalia of these of some of the Arabic stuff I've seen is, I think it is a combination of Greg and all sorts of other symbols that he put on there. And I guess the word I would use, and maybe is cryptic. It's I don't really even understand unless you were able to go through the whole text and find those symbols repeated throughout and try to figure out how he's looking at, you know, whatever he's reading there, and maybe that way you could kind of figure some of it out. Somebody could actually do a pretty good paper on this, on Nibley's marginalia. Maybe somebody has, I don't know, but it seems like it would be a pretty good thing to do to help some of us. I mean, if you go up to the ancient study, there's books in there that have a lot of his marginalia in there as well. I haven't been able to figure it all out yet, in the Arabic anyway, what he means by some of his marginalia. It's been difficult.
But nobody here has any sense that he was deliberately trying to fudge or invent or anything, right? Is any criticism like that stuck with you guys at all?
Not for me.
Not for me. I mean, it's true that sometimes he would be aggressive, like with a translation or something.
Okay.
But there was always a basis for it. I mean, you know, sometimes I would disagree with what he did, but I could see what he was doing.
Okay.
So no, I didn't see him fudging in that sense.
When I talked a little bit about that Arabic passage that I retranslated, you know, I suppose one could argue that he deliberately misrepresented that his translation there. But when I looked at the translation, I could see how he came up with what he came up with, even though it was the wrong word that he was translating. He just didn't translate that word correctly, and it just made all the difference in Arabic. And I can also see how he, maybe he wanted it to mean what it says in Alma 46. I don't know. And so that might have driven him a little bit more. But I don't see that he's trying to be misrepresenting, trying to pull something over on us there. I didn't see that at all.
And boy, does anything stuck out there. Is this still something you're hearing all the time, or is it died down? Or
I think it's died down quite a bit. I mean, you know, it's a problem. I remember my first experience with this. There's a wonderful quote, and this was in English, right? So this was from the Journal of Discourses. Wonderful quote from Brigham Young where he says, "Away with stereotyped Latter-day Saints. I don't like stereotypical Latter-day Saints." It was from his piece on leadership and management. And I went to look this up because I wanted the full quote. I thought this was just great, you know. And I got there. I found the quote. And it meant just the opposite. Brigham Young.
Oh, it meant the opposite.
Brigham Young was saying, I don't, if I'm remembering correctly, Brigham Young was saying something like, you know, we need fewer people who are saying away with stereotype Latter-day Saints. And I was really upset, you know, it was really sad and disheartening because I wanted Brigham Young so much to say that. I can't tell you how that happened other than I suspect, you know, Hugh was reading everything at a blistering pace. And, you know, he was like a speed reader. I guess he came to that and just didn't really catch the full context.
Well, he loved Brigham, so he would always give a warm reading to Brigham when he agreed with him. Yeah.
So you know, I think there's lots of cases like that where he just got it wrong. But yeah. I didn't sense ever any, you know, anything that I've found. I've never sensed anything mischievous going on. Just quick, you know, a bit sloppy and sometimes a bit careless. But, you know, and overzealous, you know. But no, I don't think there's been any sense of him trying. You know, again, going back to what Kevin said, Martha makes it sound like he's, you know, trying to deceive the whole world with these nefarious footnotes, and that's just not true. And you know, I think it's Shirley Ricks and others have found that you know, the problem has been exaggerated pretty tremendously.
Thank you.
And I think it really boils down to what Boyd was saying in terms of, if you're going to be a Fast and Furious scholar, you know, you're going to make mistakes. There's just no question about it. You're a human being. And that's the lesson I see here, is slow down. And, you know, like I told you earlier, I'm a slogger. I just kind of work through very carefully and methodically through stuff. But I'm not brilliant like Nibley either. And I didn't see the big picture like he did. And so I could see why he wanted to be Fast and Furious, probably, because he just saw so much there and wanted to capture so much and share so much. But I can also see the danger there in terms of, if you're going to be Fast and Furious, it's inevitable you're going to make mistakes.
Thanks, guys. Loved it. Appreciate that. Let's turn to the home stretch here with just maybe a few either stories from your own life, moments where a shift happened or something that has something to do with Hugh Nibley. I just want to kind of get the personal feel of this scholar and this massive output and how it's affected real lives. So I know, Boyd, you were the biographer who came later and all that stuff, so I'll save you for the last. But I'm trying to think, Kevin, maybe you're up as far as having talked the least less lately. Do you mind sharing a couple of touchstones from your own life?
Well, yeah, let me describe for you how I first encountered Hugh Nibley. I served a mission in Colorado from 1977 to 79. And when I went on my mission, you know, I thought I knew everything about the church. Because you kind of get that impression. You sit in those classes and, you know, they toss you these softball questions. And it's kind of a catechism situation. And,
right.
And it was embarrassing to answer those questions. They were so easy. So
right.
I go on a mission, and I think I know everything. And you get out on the mission, and all of a sudden, you're talking to people who are not tossing you softballs. They're high and fast up under the chin, and these are people who are asking legitimate questions that they're not convinced, and so they have questions they're asking, and I had to realize I do not know. I was really struggling at first, and so I gained from that a motivation to learn, and so we had this missionary reference set back in those days, so it's Jesus the Christ and the Articles of Faith and
Doctrines of Salvation,
all those books. So I read all that stuff, and then now what? And so the second area of my mission was in Grand Junction, and I was at a member's home, and he had a pretty good church library, and I noticed his book on his shelf, and I noticed it because it had what I instantly recognized as a Dead Sea Scroll jar on the cover. And it turned out to be Since Cumorah by this guy named Hugh Nibley. And I vaguely recalled the name Hugh Nibley because when I was a boy, I had read a children's book by Preston Nibley, Hugh's uncle, who used to be an assistant church historian. And I remember my dad talking to me and telling me how much he respected this guy's relative named Hugh. I just had that in memory. And my dad was, a very knowledgeable guy in the church. He was a professor of education. And so that kind of stuck with me. And so I asked this member, well, do you mind if I borrow that book? And he said, sure. So I took that book home and I read it. And it was completely different than anything else I had ever read in terms of church literature. It was completely different. And a lot of people, it's kind of cliche to say this, but it blew my mind. It was just so incredible. And so that was my first introduction to Hugh Nibley, was reading Since Cumorah as a young missionary, trying to get my bearings with respect to the church and the scriptures and all of that. And so I hit upon this introduction to Hugh at just a critical time in terms of my relationship with the church, and it was just powerful for me.
Would you have been bored out of the church if you hadn't discovered something like that? Is that kind of the lesson we're getting here?
a serious risk that I would have been bored right out of the church, because I needed something, to grab onto. And I wasn't really seeing much at that point.
Right, right.
And I actually got some, and then I started collecting books. I got an Approach to the Book of Mormon. I ordered that. I actually bought Message of the Joseph Smith Papyri, from the 70s bookstore on my mission. And I even read it. My little joke is I was one of 12 people in the church to read that thing. So I read those books, but I also got a hold of some taped lectures of his, because lecture tapes were a big thing in my mission.
Right.
Nobody read anything. They all listened to tapes. And it was mostly general authorities and motivational speakers. But somehow I got a hold of some Hugh Nibley fireside tapes. And I what made an impression on me was what a difference it made for him being able to control the languages. As opposed to someone who couldn't. And that made a huge impression upon me. And so even as a missionary, just based on that example, I started to try to teach myself biblical languages, using Strong's Concordance, and I bought a Berlitz Hebrew self-reader. And it's a long story, but eventually when I went back to BYU, I ended up majoring in classics, and studying Latin and Greek and Hebrew and Coptic. And that was all from Hugh's influence. And I didn't go on in graduate school. I went to law school so I could actually get a job. But I've never regretted that decision. It's been a joy to me my entire adult life. And so that was kind of how I first encountered Hugh. And then I, in my in memoriam piece, I talk about some of the other ways I encountered him at various times, small ways while I was on campus. But for me, Hugh Nibley was a tremendous influence on my intellectual development as a Mormon, and also just kind of the way I see the world. And I know I'm not going to be there for your next session about, you know, his critiques of Mormon culture, but that was a major influence on me as well. And you know, I'm a pretty liberal guy by Mormon standards, and a lot of that comes from Hugh as well. So he was just a huge influence on me. And I just have a love and admiration for the man.
Thank you very much. Brian, you mentioned your connections go back quite a bit. Do you want to share anything?
Yes. My mission was served between 77 and 79 as well, Kevin. I served in California Sacramento Mission. I was only a member of the church for a year when I was called on my mission. I come from the Catholic tradition. And so I didn't know anything about the church when I went out on my mission, actually. You at least knew something.
and knew how boring it was, or how simple it was.
Yeah, but I'd only had 12, about 12 or so fast and testimony meetings before I left on my mission. And
awesome.
So, but when I got up in Eureka, California, which is up on the northern coastline up there in North California, I think I went to a dentist or something up there, and he started talking to me about Hugh Nibley. And I said, well, I don't know too much about him. And so he started brought in some books and those kinds of things. And I brought one back to my apartment. He'd let me look at it. And I said, oh, I really like this. I think the first one he loaned to me was Since Cumorah as well, Kevin. So you and I kind of have some parallel. Maybe there's some parallelism going on there. I don't know.
But, from an ancient, from the pre-existence, it is diffused into your, never mind.
Exactly. And so, and I was just,
there's some patternism going on here.
Exactly.
Right.
And I, too, was listening to tapes, of course, you know, Floyd Weston's 17 Points of the True Church, you know, God is a Gardener by Hubie Brown, you know, some of those. And I don't know if you guys remember Einar Erickson's talks on the Dead Sea Scrolls, where he was proving, you know, the church was true.
We had all those, too.
Yeah. You know, so I had all that stuff. But Nibley was somebody different. He was somebody that just got me to thinking. And so I started bothering this dentist who was in our ward. I was serving in the ward that he was in. And he said, well, why don't you just come over on your P-Day and I'll let you take the books that you want and you can just copy them off. And I said, great. And so he had this old Xerox machine. And so I would just be there for hours on P-Days just copying off page after page after page of Nibley's publications and then putting them in binders and stacking them in my room, you know, and at the apartment there. And so by the time I was done, I just had, you know, just a ton of material there of Nibley stuff, and I would just read that stuff. You have to understand it was a lot more lax back in those days than it is now. You know, they didn't really come down yet as hard about what you should be reading. And so I just read whatever I felt like reading at that time. Although I suppose they did have some rules there, but I was too new. I didn't know that much about anything, and so it was. But that was the beginning for me as well. And so by the time I got off my mission, came to BYU in 1980, I wanted to go into Hebrew studies. Somebody talked me into doing Arabic studies instead, just to try it out. And if I didn't like it, to go into Hebrew studies. I did end up liking Arabic, and I stayed with that. But I went all the way up through the PhD level in Arabic, and I was able to go down and visit with Hugh Nibley on my dissertation, and he consulted me on some things with my dissertation in his ancient scripture office there, whatever, ancient studies office, I think it was, and was very helpful, very kind. He's a very kind man, and even up to the very point that I'm at right now, I attribute to Hugh Nibley. I attribute my getting hired at BYU to Nibley because if it weren't for him, I wouldn't have gone gone through taken the academic route that I did, and so I'll be forever grateful for that. And so I look at Hugh Nibley as for me in my life anyway, as a very powerful influence.
Thank you. And I'm going to give you a chance to tell another story, each of you, if you'd like. Let me ask this right now, though. Is there any sense, you guys, there's sort of this, I think there's a lot of people that are making fast decisions about Mormonism. Well, it's not what Joseph Smith said exactly it was. I've got a bolt. I mean, there's no reason for me to stick around. And so, was there any sense in either of your lives, and Boyd, you're welcome to, too, when you might have had a moment of doubt or something like that, and you're thinking, wow, how can I, hear the level of this literalistic level or this shallow level that's preached at church, and yet I know from, my own studies or something, it's a much more complex picture. Has a Hugh Nibley and just this sort of, there's just a sense to me, so maybe I'm just putting this forth as a thesis, and you can say yes or no. He helps you slow down. He helps you take the bigger perspective. He helps you just simply say, there's no way on earth that this deserves a fast decision, because whether his specifics hold up or not, there's just this whole realm of life and history and language and myth and all that stuff that he just helps me stop and ponder and weigh and never want to feel hasty. Does that make any sense as a thesis? Has that worked in your life at all in any of those kinds of ways?
It absolutely has in mine. It's funny that so many people encounter Nibley on their missions. I didn't. And it's probably a good thing, because my mission actually had very strict rules about what you could read. And it was that little set, of Jesus the Christ and the pathway to perfection or whatever. And I remember feeling horribly guilty when a member in my ward sent me a Truman Madsen book, Christ in the
Inner. What an apostate, yeah.
I felt so horrible that I sent the book home. And so if I'd encountered Nibley on my mission, I probably would have associated him with guilt. So it's a thing. But I think the thing that really helped me is that he came at a time in my life when I was starting to enter a kind of more mature world of thinking about the gospel. And, I'd just been back from my mission, and I was getting into those classes that were starting to challenge me. I was very involved in at the time we had kind of this Mormon underground of passing photocopied things around, and so I was very involved in that. And Hugh really did have it's like you said, there was a weight there that helped me to kind of not make quick decisions. I always felt like there was good evidence that I couldn't just dismiss easily. And
it wasn't necessarily evidence of exact literal way it's presented. It was there, but there's evidence of, what would the evidence be of that you're kind of talking there?
It's like I say, that Peleg thing really hit me, because, we don't have to view it in this, in one way or another way. It can be in a third or fourth or fifth way that we haven't even considered,
Nice.
Those easy answers, I just felt like there was weight in Nibley. Again, it wasn't the particulars of his evidence, but in the kind of overall vision he constructed of this ancient world, of a gospel that's very expansive and inclusive of all these different cultures and all these different ideas. The gospel became a bigger thing for me instead of shrinking, as I encountered these new worlds of biology and science and other religions. It didn't freak me out, because Nibley had already gone in those places. And, again, I didn't always agree with him, and sometimes I flat out disagreed with him, but I always felt like, I can grow up with this, and I'm not going to freak out. He kind of gave me this sense of the church is bigger than this.
Nice. Either of the other guys reacting to kind of what my thesis about hastiness and heft or anything like that?
Well, the word that comes to my mind is kind of richness. He kind of modeled being able to see the scriptures and the church and things like that. Instead of just simplistically, you're being able to see the richness in them. And for me, I needed that. And that was really a gift for me because it has helped me to maintain my faith in the gospel. Whereas it easily, I can see it easily just, you know, drying up and withering away, you know, without being able to perceive how rich these things can really be when you look at them closely. So, you know, for me, it's not any one specific thing in particular. It's just modeling, you know, a rich approach to the gospel and to the scriptures.
And I think that's kind of where I come from, too, particularly with Boyd's comment about, you know, how Nibley penetrated lots of different cultures and religions and growing up Catholic and then coming into the church. You know, I've always had a sensitivity to other faiths anyway, and so I'm rather ecumenical in my thinking. You know, I have a hard time, you know, being too exclusive, I guess. And that's hard for some people, I know, to be exclusive in your beliefs. And if you have this set of beliefs, then you're a Mormon. But if you don't, if you're outside that set of beliefs, you're not considered Mormon or Orthodox or something. And we all have to, I guess, grapple with that to a certain degree. But, you know, when you're dealing with questions and when you're dealing with making hasty decisions and those kinds of things, Nibley comes and says, no, think this through. There's other ways of looking at this. And for me, Nibley was a big tent Mormon. I look at Nibley as a person who was accepting of lots of points of view out there when it comes to, because if you really think about it, you know, we don't have, you know, a definitive answer on much anyway as far as the gospel goes. And so, you know, we're left to have discussions and conversations. And I like the dialogue. I like the conversations. I like to be able to, and that's where you can, and not be hasty. That's where you can slow down and talk things through and try to understand things better. And you don't have to check out. You know, it's not necessary that you have to do that. This is a big church. It should be able to accommodate all kinds of people. And that's kind of the way I look at it.
Loved it. Thank you, all you guys.
See that not only in his thought, but in his life. I mean, I was with him once when one of his kind of disciples was there, and they got talking about somebody, I don't even remember who, and the person kind of dismissed him by saying, oh, but he's a Buddhist. And he was like, well, what's wrong with that? That's a great tradition. There's great stuff there. You know, have you read anything? I mean, he was really kind of challenging this person. And, you know, I think Brian's absolutely right. It was a big tent picture. And, you know, Joseph Smith, I think his mind was so broad and very syncretic in the sense that he was drawing in all these different things from different places. And Hugh Nibley was doing the same kind of thing. I really admire him for the way he was just open to ideas. Hugh once said that Joseph Smith said that you can never be damned for believing too much, and that was one of Hugh Nibley's favorite lines. And I love that. Just this idea that you can't be damned because you have too many ideas. It's damning when you limit your ideas.
Very good.
I've got one more thing I wanted to say. You know, people might get the impression that I sit around reading Nibley. I haven't picked up a Nibley book for ages, and I just don't feel the need to. I mean, I've read it all, and that was fine in its time. You know, these days I'm actually more interested in his life, and so that's why I was so glad that Boyd wrote his book. I have read that probably a half a dozen times since it came out, because it's, to me, it's just inspirational, the way he lived his life and what he did. And I recognize his influence of his writings in my life, but I just don't feel the need to revisit those all the time. You know, in that sense, I've kind of moved on a little bit.
Would you still recommend to somebody in this generation taking that time and that effort to at least dive into some of it, though?
Well, yeah. If someone's new to it, by all means, they should explore it. But having done it all myself in the past, I don't go back to Since Gomorrah and say, oh, let me reread this. You know, I feel like I've absorbed it pretty much, and it's already had, it's worked its influence on me, and so it's already done its job on me. It seems like. So in terms of anything I do now, I'm more interested in Hugh the man rather than, Hugh the religious scholar.
I would second that. Kudos to Boyd for that wonderful book. I picked it up right away myself and read through it, and I've loved that book ever since. And I feel the same way. We at the Maxwell Institute, of course, sometimes we'll have to go through, and of course, you know that Joe Smith papyri and Egyptian endowment, that was updated. And so every once in a while, some of us do go back and go over his stuff and update his sources and those kinds of things. I did that with his meaning of the Kirtland Egyptian papers. We issued an update of that. And so, some of us do go back, but it's mostly for, utility purposes, that kind of thing. It's not really for reading for the first time kind of thing that we've already done.
Yeah, and so I was trying to get this with Kevin, and now I want to say it again with you, Brian. You're saying in your own personal worlds, your own personal thought worlds, faith worlds, it's not necessary for you to go there, but would you still say there's a role for somebody encountering Hugh today?
Absolutely. Absolutely, because he laid some foundational things, and a person should know those if they're going to get into the field.
So what would you guys let, when we get to the social critique, I'll ask the panel there what the two or three key entry texts might be. What would any of the three of you say would be somebody who wants to kind of get a feel for the ancient world, explode the ancient world for us kind of stuff?
I would go right for his Book of Mormon stuff, because that's where he's really laying the foundation of his ancient studies there, in my mind, with his first books there with Lehi in the Desert, and There Were the Jaredites, and the approach to the Book of Mormon, some of those books.
So the manual, okay, the Book of Mormon manual.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's where I would kind of start out at.
Kind of an older generation than me, they always cut their nibbly teeth on Lehi in the Desert and the Worlds of the Jaredites. And I just, as it worked out, I cut mine on Since Gomorrah, and so I'm kind of biased that way. I would say start with Since Gomorrah, because that's how I first experienced Nibley, and it was such a magical thing for me. I would suggest others do the same.
Boyd, what do you think?
Well, it's funny, because I guess I am the older generation, even though I think I'm a little bit younger than you, Kevin. I have to say Lehi in the Desert. The thing I find fun about that, not only is the arguments he's making, but it's fun to see his mind at this early age. I mean, that's one of his first installments in this, really, of trying to situate Lehi in this ancient world. And I found that really captivating. I of course went on and read Since Gomorrah and the approach to the Book of Mormon, and then there's a compilation of essays that Farms put together of writings on the Book of Mormon. I'm forgetting the title right now, but those are all terrific. But there's something about the freshness of Lehi in the Desert that I still just love. And I think that's it's all good. It's really good stuff. And so, again, I have to say I'm probably in the same place as Brian and Kevin in that I don't tend to read a lot of the Book of Mormon stuff right now, but the social criticism, that stuff is still extremely fresh to me. I can read that over and over again, there's something about those early Book of Mormon things that really, it's exciting. It's a breath of fresh air seeing this, this is just a revolutionary moment in church history in some ways that the church was finally coming to see the Book of Mormon in a completely new way. And Nibley's approach was really monumental there.
All right. There's one last area that I definitely want to cover. And, Brian, it was your comment about Buddhism and Hugh, like, what's wrong with Buddhism? It's a great religion or something like that. That kind of reminded me of this final area. There's all these rumors going around that Hugh had unorthodox beliefs in certain things. You know, I've heard from some people that, you know, one-on-one, Hugh would tell them, for instance, that he's a strong believer in reincarnation, or at least he holds open, you know, some version of that. You know, we'll often find in some fundamentalist circles and things like that, you do get a sense of multiple mortal probations and the potter's clay being, you know, goes back on the potter's wheel and all those things. But, you know, there's like, oh, yeah, he confessed to me in private that he really believed in this. And then the other one that's super persistent, and perhaps you guys have heard of more, is that Hugh believed in the Adam God doctrine. In other words, even though it officially fell out of favor with the church, he still thought it made a lot of sense and maybe privately held that belief. And so, Boyd, I'd love you to do this. You and I, when we talked in the interview for A Thoughtful Faith, you did some talking about this. And so would you mind kind of addressing that? I'm sure people are coming up to you all the time saying, did you really believe this thing? And just, you know, et cetera. So thanks.
Well, you know, it's funny because on the one hand, you know, Hugh was using so many different types of sources, you know, Egyptian stuff, and that Egyptian papyri book is just full of all kinds of this esoterica. And so I think sometimes people are a bit overzealous in reading Nibley and thinking that he really does believe in this. And then when they would talk to him, you know, I saw firsthand sometimes where Nibley, just to try to get rid of people, he would just quickly agree with them.
Oh, man.
He didn't really want to, you know, spend a lot of time on this topic, so he'd kind of agree with them and let them go. So I don't think he was way out there. But I think in terms of, you know, his reading, he loved Brigham Young, as you mentioned, and you know, I never heard him say, "I believe in the Adam God doctrine." I never heard him say that, but it occurred to me when I was a student at BYU. I was, you know, fresh from a mission, newly married, and really zealous about the church, and you know, he'd written all this stuff that was apologetic, defending the faith, and I thought, why hasn't he addressed that issue? And so I asked him, I said, why haven't you talked about that? The anti-Mormons get us on that all the time. And he said, oh, I never think about that. And he just didn't want to talk about it. He said, well, let me revise that. I don't talk about that. And so the implication to me, I mean, if, you know, was that he probably believed in it. He never confessed it. But he also said in several of his Brigham Young writings that he felt like Brigham Young was a better theologian than he's been given credit for. So I think there's, you know, my gut feeling is that he had very strong sympathies for that theology. As for reincarnation, I don't know, you know, where he would feel about, what he would feel about that. You know, the ideas of moving between kingdoms that, you know, were very popular in the 19th century. I think he would have probably gone with that. I think he really loved those 19th century theological ideas. I know that he was a strong believer in guardian angels. I heard him talk about that all the time. And from the way he drove, I'm convinced that there were, because he was constantly distracted as a driver, and driving in a car with him, I think you come to believe in guardian angels. But, you know, and that was during the days of Bruce R. McConkie saying there weren't guardian angels. So,
oh, okay.
So that's one evidence, one instance. You know, he, in terms of evolution, he was kind of interesting there, because on the one hand, he didn't agree with creationism. He felt like, you know, one of the problems with creationism is that it limits the perspective of humans and animals. He said, you know, Mormons believe that animals have spirits. And so, you know, he couldn't go along with creationism. He couldn't go all the way with evolution. So he kind of came down the middle, and he argued pretty persuasively for pre-Adamites.
Right. That was out on the limb a bit there, yeah.
So that was kind of an interesting bit. And then we talked a little bit about blacks in the priesthood last time, I guess. But, you know, during that Lester Bush piece, he argued that the reason Pharaoh didn't have the priesthood was because he was going through a matriarchal line, not through a patriarchal line. And so his claim to priesthood was bogus that way, not based on skin, which mm-hmm. was kind of an interesting moment theologically.
But that one and pre-Adamites, he at least said out loud.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you're basically saying he was adventurous and he was bold. And when it wasn't like too far out there, it sounds like he'd be willing to put it in print. I guess, so I love more of those. So tell more of those if you'd like to. But I just wanted to clarify that the earlier ones like Reincarnation and Adam God, he wouldn't ever commit to print, even if he had some degree of warmth towards them in his heart. He wouldn't probably have said those out loud. Maybe he would share one-on-one with a person.
Maybe. I mean, I felt like I got to be pretty close with him, and I never heard him ever say, you know, I believe in Adam God, but like I say, I got a pretty good indication that he did.
Right, or at least that you don't dismiss it out of hand, you know, because that's the way I am on half a dozen things or more.
Yeah, I think that's true. And he had such a great respect for other religions. And, you know, again, going back to what Brian just said, Hugh had this big picture theology. And, you know, I think he could see patterns and symbols and things that tied together where other people would probably dismiss them. And so, you know, even if somebody was talking about reincarnation, he may see a pattern or a symbol there that he thought was really appropriate and part of a bigger picture a bigger tapestry that he wanted to tap into. And so, you know, he was a very big picture kind of guy.
I loved it, guys. Thank you so much for this conversation. Let me just give you one last chance to say anything that you haven't said. Otherwise, we'll head on out of this. Kevin, start with you with anything left.
No, I think my tank is empty. I think it's been a great conversation, and I want to thank you for the opportunity. And it's been an honor to talk about someone who I felt was a mentor to me, even though not physically or in person, but just through his writing.
Thank you. Wonderful. Brian?
You know, I think it was Neil A. Maxwell said, a person like Hugh Nibley comes around every 1,000 years, and he's kind of like, you know, he's kind of like a Maimonides, you know, or a Ghazali or somebody like that, or an Aquinas type person, you know. I'm just an Augustine, you know, somebody like that, just pivotal person that he, you know, we're going to be talking about Nibley, you know, probably 100 years from now, I would think, even if his scholarship has kind of maybe gets outdated, still what he did, laying some of those foundations, will stay with us for a long time to come. And I, too, am grateful for his influence in my life, for being a mentor for me. And I'm grateful that I was able to be on your podcast, Dan. Thank you.
Oh, loved it. Thank you. Boyd, where would you stop?
Well, I would just say thank you. I mean, I think I owe both Kevin and Brian royalties for praising my book.
And I owe you guys lunch for your stamina. Next time I see each of you, I'm buying.
But it was a fun discussion, Dan. Thanks.
Well, thank you, you guys. I hope that this has been fun for our listeners. I'm sure it has been. Again, I'm hoping that there's a whole generation here that are discovering this guy. They've heard the name, and now maybe they're going to try a book or two and at least get that sense of, I loved your term, richness there. People are always teasing me on my podcast when I talk about the robustness of Mormonism and our theology, and that, you know, we never want to leave a thin version of Mormonism. If you're going to make a decision like that, you know, go for the most robust and wonderful thing. And I love that we've talked about Hugh, because he certainly presents an image or at least a vision of God. And then, you know, to me, the mix of a scholar, like you say, a 1,000-year scholar, these polymaths, you know, whoever's going to come along very often that loves languages this much or is willing to, you know, expand to such wide reading in this area of specialization these days. So we're going to miss that. But then you combine it with this mystical temperament, this person that would loves to participate in rituals, who will sit there in the temple and not only, you know, he says, I learned something new every time I'd go to the temple, but it wouldn't be just that he's playing in the realm of the parallels and he's seeing some new connection that way. My sense is with him it was this I'm now in liminal space, I'm now where the veil is thin, and there's this kind of this infusion of spirit that I'm sure, you know, it's just, again, what a rare combination, right? That's just amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so there's something there to honor in every way possible, and thank you guys for 2.5 hours. And hopefully people will listen, and I think and trust they will. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, good night, you guys, and really appreciate you. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.